Just reviewing some of the points in the discussion about the phenomenon of the gifts, the clothing and jewelry that the Jews were commanded to request from the Egyptians. And as we said, God communicates this to Abraham in a general way, that when the Jews leave, they will leave with rechush. They won't leave empty-handed, and they will leave yetzu berchush gadol, with great possessions. So they won't leave in an impoverished state. However, that's all the information that's communicated. How they're going to get that wealth is not stated to Abraham. And there are many ways it could have been done. Here it becomes more specific. When God speaks to Moshe, apparently it's important for Moshe. Moshe is the one that's going to be carrying out the instructions. It's more important for Moshe to know the particulars. It gets more specific. So here there's another component. God says that I'll place the favor of the nation in the eyes of Egypt. See, that is now connected to the idea that when they leave, they won't leave empty-handed. It'll have to do with the phenomenon of the favor. So that's a new element. We have to understand what the point is, what the significance is. How did it come about? Is there something we can learn from it? Is it just a miracle? That is, in ordinary terms, according to the natural law, there's no reason why they should have felt this chain, and God just says, I'll do it. Which is difficult to understand. Usually it works through natural. God is responsible, of course, but the manner in which it happened, does it have anything to do with what was going on in Egypt? Is there something we can learn from it with regard to this issue of chayin? And then it says how they'll acquire the wealth. It will be that a woman will ask her neighbor and someone who lives in her house, vessels of silver, all right, jewelry, silver, gold, clothing, and you will place them on your sons and daughters, and you'll empty out Egypt. So it's going to be a significant amount over here. Now, already you can see the ambivalency. It's interesting that the Torah chose the terminology which could be a little ambivalent. In the sense, will they borrow? Vishola, does that mean borrow? Or does that mean request? But it'll be for a gift. And these are two legitimate possibilities, two legitimate ways of learning. The Ibn Ezra comments on the idea that God will place the favor, Vinosati. So the Ibn Ezra says, Gamze hayadav apela. This too is a wondrous thing. Shemitzriim hayu mefaisin es Yisrael sheyishalu mehem. That the Egyptians will be mefais, would pacify the Jews, who would ask from them. V'zetam v'yashilum. V'zehepach mishpat anshei ha'olam. And this is the opposite of the way of mankind. That is to say that the Egyptians would want to give it to them. There was no resistance over here. It seems to be something which is somewhat miraculous. And the Chamali does bring down a position which justifies what the Jews did on the basis of the fact that the Jews were entitled to compensation. That they had... I think it's in the form of... It's in the Gemara. I think it's Sanhedrin. That at some point some Egyptian... This is going, you know, later on. During the time when the Jews again were living in Alexandria, and he leveled charges against the Jews that they owed them the money for the gifts that they had taken, something to that effect. And the answer was, you know, he showed him the pasuk that all the labor that the Jews labored for the Egyptians, which seems to imply that it made it legitimate. That to me seems like a very compelling argument. We did discuss it in conjunction with the reparations. What about after World War II? So there was a whole issue of reparations. What the Nazis had stolen from the Jews. Forget about it's not just a question of the labor, the forced labor. It gets much worse than that, obviously. The destruction, the killing, things that can't be repaid. And the labor, the slave labor, and so on and so forth. In that situation, the Jews were entitled to take, in my opinion, whatever they could have taken. It didn't work out that there was negotiations, because as we said, the new German government wanted to exonerate itself, to get some measure of respect. So they wanted to give. They wanted to give Israel, they wanted to give the Jews reparations for the sake of their, for purely selfish reasons. But had they not wanted it to do so, it seems to me that Jews would have been entitled to get the money back, even if it meant deceiving them. Theoretically, if there was a way that they could have deceived them to get it back, I think that it would have been justifiable, because when you're cheated, when somebody else cheats you out of your money, you have a right to that money, and if it's necessary for you to deceive him, he's not entitled anymore to honesty and truthfulness, because he's a thief. So then, it's not theft anymore if you manipulate him to give you back what's yours. You're acting in accordance with justice. That argument can be made over here, it seems to me, that the Egyptians had enslaved the Jews, expropriated everything from them, the labor. I don't know what else they may have taken from them, but the labor itself, to make you into a slave, stealing your labor, that's a tremendous amount of money right there, all those years. So one could argue that the Jews were entitled to reparations. It's interesting, though, still, in all, it's never placed as a demand that Moshe makes. Moshe never makes this demand. It's something which God instructed them to. It was God's will, not just that they should leave with wealth, that's clear, but that they should go to the Egyptians and make the request and receive it as gifts from the Egyptians. That's clear. The Evan Ezra does mention that there are those who complain and say that our forefathers were thieves. And his answer is that you should take a look and say that the Jews didn't act on their own. They acted in accordance with the divine command. That's a very brilliant explanation. That the Jews did not go on their own. To the contrary, they had to be encouraged to make the request. And you can't ask why. Because God created everything. And he gave wealth to whom he sees fit. And he takes it. He takes it from his hand and gives it to somebody else. And that's not evil. Because it's everything belongs to him. It's the will of God. So that clearly is another line of defense. He's not using the argument over here. Apparently, according to the Evan Ezra, there's no need to get into any other kind of argument. There's no need to get into the argument as to whether the Jews had a right to do this, because he's saying they didn't act on their own. Had they acted on their own, it would seem that he might have an issue. So it's not that clear whether they had a right to act on their own. But to him, it's very, very simple that they only acted on the command of God, which means to say that they knew that it was God's will. In the same way, what right did they have to invade the land of Canaan and drive out the inhabitants and take over the land? It wasn't their land. Yeah, the answer is that's the first Rashi in Bereishis. God established the world. God determines who should be in this place, who should be in that place. It's God's will that they forfeited the land. So the Jews were only acting in accordance with the will of God. So in this particular situation, the same is true. Yes, just to complete the review, as we've seen, there are other commentators that learn that it wasn't a request for lending, for borrowing something. It just means that they asked for gifts. Obviously, if that's the way you learn, so then there's no problem. It makes it harder to accept, though, that it's interesting that according to that, you'd have to assume that the attitude that the Egyptians had to the Jews was such that they wanted them. It's hard to understand that they would be so enamored with the Jews now that they would give away their wealth, give away vessels of gold. It's hard enough to accept it that they just lend it to them, but then they expected to get it back. The Sforno says that it was a loan, but once they chased after the Jews by the splitting of the Red Sea and declared war on the Jews, they were, so that's the laws of war, that to the victor belongs the spoils. So once they declared war against the Jews, they lost their rights to everything, and the Jews were victorious. They had a right to keep it. That's the Sforno's explanation. But you see, he too is troubled with the issue that if it was a law, he didn't accept that idea, though, apparently. The Sforno apparently did not accept the idea that they had a right to take it because of their labors. The question that we raised at the outset is, what is the significance of this? What was the purpose? If it was merely a practical, we can see the practicality of it, that a nation needs a certain amount of material resources. They needed resources. So it's true they're going to enter into the land and they're going to inherit the infrastructure, so to speak, of what's in the land, but then you have individuals. And they would have something to start with. But it's more than just that. Because it seems that it was the will of God that they should make the request. And it would come about through the phenomenon of chen. That's also important. What difference does it make? Who cares that that God placed the charm of the Jews in the eyes of the Egyptians? Who cares? Why is that important? That's part and parcel of it. That they would receive this as a result of that phenomenon. That they would experience that. That the Egyptians, would have a certain type of an attitude towards them in which they would want them to take these gifts. If you turn to chapter 11, this idea comes up again. And again, and God says now to Moshe, Dabar Nobi Ozneam, speak to the people, and that each man will request of his friend, and each woman will request from her friend, vessels of silver, vessels of gold. Then it says that God placed the favor of the nation in the eyes of Egypt, Gam Ha'ish Moshe, also the man Moshe, Gadol Mi'od B'Eretz Mitzrayim, was exceedingly great in the land of Egypt, B'Enei Avdei Paro, in the eyes of the servants of Paro, U'B'Enei Ha'am, and in the eyes of the people. So here you have yet an additional element, the idea of Moshe, which seemingly is unconnected. What does that have to do with the charm, and what does it have to do with the giving of the gifts? But it's connected over here, telling us, Gam Ha'ish Moshe, that the man Moshe was exceedingly great. So there is a connection over here. I think the phenomenon of gifts over here and the way God instructed them to go about it, and it's connected with the idea of chen, that the Jews would experience that sense of admiration, whatever, you know, that they felt a certain love of them or charm, whatever it is. They looked at them as being special people. Clearly as part of the process of the geula, of the redemption. The redemption has to take place on many, many levels. You see that there's the four expressions of redemption. Now let's see if we can isolate some of the elements. We've mentioned many times, the worst aspect of the enslavement, the worst aspect of any kind of an enslavement, of any kind of mistreatment, is the psychological wound that it leaves with the person, the psychological effect, in that the person loses a certain sense of self-respect, a certain sense of dignity, which is vital for a person to function properly. There's different terms, self-esteem or feeling of worthlessness. When a person has that feeling of being looked down upon, it can destroy them if they have no way of defending themselves against it. Now, there are many people that really don't care. You have that story that we always quote, the Rambam's Pirush, about that a person should be shval ruach, that a person should be exceedingly humble, and not really care at all about his pride, his dignity in the sense of how people regard him. So he tells the story about that individual who was on the ship, and somebody urinated on him. You know, we've done. And that person said that was the happiest day of his life, because it didn't bother him at all. It's a very, very high level. But one should appreciate the ideal. One should seek to appreciate the ideal that's involved. The immediate reaction of most people is that, forget about that, you know, like that's just a little too much. Well, that's true, and a person has to know themselves. very few people would be on the level where it wouldn't bother them. But you have to recognize that that's a very high level, because he's completely liberated from that phenomenon of how people look at him, that that should matter. He's living in a different frame. Obviously, the Jews were not on that level at this point in time. At this point in time, they were not on that level. If they were on a certain kind of a level where they didn't really care about this whole idea, if they were perfected in Torah and their sense of importance or dignity or significance had to do with the fact that they have the Torah, then they would look down on the Egyptians pretty much as being animals, and it wouldn't matter what the Egyptians thought of them. To the contrary, that's the situation of the individual on the boat. He recognized that that person was an animalistic individual and derived a certain bizarre pleasure from humiliating others, but it had nothing to do with him. It didn't bother him in any way because he was on a high plane. The Jews were not on that plane at this point in time. To the contrary, they were affected by the Egyptians because that was part of the problem. They didn't resist. They didn't fight against. They identified with the Egyptian way of life to a large extent, and that's why many of them became involved in idolatry and so on. So therefore, the enslavement clearly created a big psychological wound, made them feel inferior. And the struggle against the feeling of inferiority was a major aspect of the whole story in the wilderness. Ultimately, they weren't able to overcome it to the extent that they were able to go in and conquer the land. But God wanted to give them the opportunity. You see that the Hashkacha, the divine providence, relates to them. God is not going to give them the courage. That's something which depends upon their free will. So God is not just going to implant the courage within you and without your having to do anything. It's just automatic. It doesn't work that way. On the other hand, it would seem that to expect these people to be transformed emotionally merely as a result of the plagues and the exodus and so on, all these things would have an impact. How lasting an impact, it's not clear. Because you see, after the miracle of the Yom Suf, the splitting of the Red Sea, they were in a state of exultation and Shira and complete belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but 3 days later they complained. So miracles don't last very long. To the extent that the Jews suffered inwardly, and you see that that's extremely important, that can't be ignored. The inward wound, the extraneous situation of the enslavement, that can be alleviated. That's not as difficult. But the transformation of the person, that the person doesn't feel like a slave anymore, that's very, very difficult to contend with. Now here we see that the mistreatment of the Egyptians, the fact that they were looked down upon as worse than second-class citizens, as slaves, is something that affects people for a long time. You could see it. I don't mean to disparage anyone, because you know we respect the dignity of all people. But you see it in America today with like the blacks, for example. That's part of the struggle. It affects people to a large extent because they refuse to acknowledge it. They refuse to acknowledge that they feel insecure, lacking in confidence. So then it creates a certain hostility and an anger, and they blame others. That you have a certain segment of blacks that are always blaming their faults. But you see, there are many blacks who've been able to elevate themselves, to take advantage and to compete, and they do just as good as anybody else. It depends on the attitude. Those who have the attitude that this is something that happened in the past, and America passed laws, and it's the civil rights laws, and now we have opportunities, and even if we have handicaps, we can overcome those handicaps through hard work. Those who take that attitude will succeed. That was the attitude of all the different groups that came to America, which had handicaps. Like the Jews had there was anti-Semitism, and other groups had to. Every group, generally speaking, when they come into a new environment, there's going to be certain prejudices. However, as long as they don't stop you from playing the game, as long as you have a right to go to the schools, you can apply for a job, you can work hard, you can start a business. So those groups that came here with that idea to work very, very hard were successful, and they educated their children, They took advantage of the educational system. The first generation was paid the price, so to speak. They did all the hard work, working by day and by night. All they wanted was their children should have a shot. And their children were raised with that ethic. They put all that energy into studying, and they became doctors and lawyers, professionals. You know, that's the way it goes. To a large extent, the blacks in America didn't go through that similar process. And those who did take that route were very successful. Those who did not, and I think that has a lot to do with the leaders too, that a lot of leaders exploit them, and the whole basis of their leadership is to criticize the system. The system has to make special things for them and affirmative action for them and so on and so forth. I'm not getting into the particularities, whether it's justified or not. But that attitude that you have to take care of me because of what you did to me is not a good, it doesn't work. And you see in a lot of black communities, it's not just black, I'm just using it as an example, you know, the broken homes, the drug abuse, etc., etc. The out-of-wedlock pregnancy rate is killing them, yeah. Killing the whole community. So I'm just using that as a general illustration that I think it has to do with a certain psychological attitude that was never addressed. It's not, I don't believe that they're inferior. But the psychological attitude and the values that you adopt will have a tremendous impact. Now, what's going on over here is a transformation of the attitude of the Egyptians. That the Jews, I would deduce, the Jews were clearly affected by the attitude of the Egyptians. That the Egyptians looked at them in a certain way was bothersome to them. And even if they were freed, they needed compensation. I would say the compensation is very important. That they should not harbor resentments. They should have a complete sense of gratitude to God, not just that God removed them from the enslavement, but God restored them. God restored them to a position where they were full-fledged human beings on every level, psychologically as well. And that their dignity was restored. As far as that is concerned, what was necessary was a transformation of the attitude of the Egyptians towards them. They imagined that the Egyptians looked down on them. That's also a very important teaching, by the way. It helps you to overcome this. People get preoccupied. This is one of the most paralyzing things in life. People are preoccupied with how other people think about them. It really, you always worry about that. It hampers you from being yourself and feeling free. And how much energy is diverted because of your concern about how you look in the eyes of others. It's magnified, it's distorted. It also prevents you from pursuing that which is true. Because you're always concerned, how will others perceive it. Now, it's interesting, there's many things to be said about that, but what's very interesting is that how you distort, how your view, your perception of how other people think of you is so completely distorted. How often do you think that people are upset with you when it turns out they weren't upset with you? Or people don't like you? I mean, you project. There's a certain projection going on. There's a certain distortion going on. It's not always accurate. The way you imagine people think of you is not necessarily always true. It's being pointed out that maybe I shouldn't be so quick about that because it turns out that many people speak very obnoxiously behind your back, speak lush and hard about you, and so on and so forth. Yeah, but there too, I think that in a sense maybe even supports my point. That's not the accurate barometer. People, when they get together, like to engage in Lashon Hara. And somebody can bring up a subject and everybody joins in, and if you were to hear them, you'll think, wow, they really hate this person. But that's not the truth. Because a half hour later, they'll bump into you and they'll be very nice to you. Even that is a distortion. If you were to accidentally be present, I don't know how many people would want to do that, eavesdrop, when a group of your friends are talking about you, and maybe disparaging you to a certain extent. In a sense, it would be healthy, though, because you would probably cease to be concerned anymore about what they think about me. Who cares if that's... But it wouldn't be accurate either. It's not accurate, because what you're failing to take into consideration is that when people get together and start talking, it creates certain emotions, and people join in, and it can be a very exaggerated thing. Even that, because afterwards somebody will say, that's not really how I feel about you. But they were enjoying. People have a need to vent. That's why Lashon Hara is a very powerful attraction. So that if, let's assume that could happen, that you overheard friends talking about you, and then you confronted one of them later, that person might say to you, but I don't really feel that way about you. You know that. So why did you say that? Because I got crazy. It was an emotion of the moment, and I indulged. So Lashon Hara is something that people indulge in. They indulge certain aggressive, sadistic emotions. There's a lot of aggression and sadism in there that needs an outlet. On a certain level, there's something surprising about this. The fact that the Jews would be very reluctant to make this request. That's why, that they need to be encouraged. They're saying, no, we can't ask them, they hate us. The very fact that they will be surprised is also significant. That shows you that you don't even know what the other person is thinking about you. You're wrong. The fact that they would discover that they were completely wrong about how the Egyptians would think about them is of some significance, it seems to me. Let's see, however, if we can understand the miracle. It seems to be a bit of a miracle. God says, I will bring it about. Does that mean that that's it? There's no way we can understand it? Or no, God is the source of all those things that happen, but if you think about it, it does make sense. On the surface, it doesn't seem to make sense. To the contrary, they didn't like the Jews, it would seem, to begin with. Especially when the Jews began to multiply. It says, Vayakutsum ibn Ibn Yisrael. They became sort of disgusted. The Jews were all over the place. Not to mention the fact that the Jews were an abomination because of their religion. And they were people who worshipped idols, worshipped sheep, and so on and so forth. So, and in this situation, they've just gone through 10 plagues. Ostensibly because of the Jews. And Moshe Rabbeinu, why should he? He became very great. That too had to be surprising. I would imagine it's surprising to Moshe Rabbeinu. Because he said, who am I to be the leader? I'm not disqualified. The idea that they would actually respect him, not only Gadol Meod, was exceedingly great. It shows you that there are deeper forces at work in these situations that we're not aware of. Even with regard to a person's popularity. A good example of chayin, of someone who has chayin, is Esther. Because the Megillah keeps pointing out that she found favor in the eyes of Kol Ro'eh. She had that quality. That everybody who met her found it to be very likable. So there are people that have that likability. Congeniality, whatever you want to call it. I think, I'm just suggesting this, I'm just putting it out there, that the charm had to do with the way they perceived the Jews in terms of God. This is what brought about the change. That it seems all people have the capability of recognizing the Creator, of recognizing God. Even though they differ and disagree, but the way it unfolded, Moshe Rabbeinu, for example, he became exceedingly great. But why? He was tormenting Egypt. I mean, he wasn't really tormenting them, but that's the way it appeared. He was going to Paro, he was challenging him. But interestingly enough, there's tremendous admiration. A person who has that courage, the courage to confront Paro, the ability to stand up for the Jews and to talk about God, and nothing happens to him. And all of his predictions come true. So the way in which Moshe conducted, and you see that it wasn't just God that brought about these phenomena. God, of course, God brought it about. It was God's might and all of that. But in conjunction with the activities of a certain people. The fact that Moshe was extremely respected, that also had an impact upon the people. Because that has to do, that's, the pride of a people is affected by many things. One of the most significant things is their leaders. If a people has great leaders, and they're great leaders, and they're also respected by others, that has a, that's an important element in the self-respect of each people, of each person rather. That's a very, very important phenomenon. So God also brought that about, that they would have a leader that gives them a certain sense of respect, a certain sense of dignity, that we have leaders. A people without leaders are lacking in something. They don't even have leaders. They're just a group. They're just a rabble. That A, the Jews would have leaders, and that they, these leaders were great people in the eyes of not just the people, but in the eyes of the enemy, in the eyes of Egypt. That too was part of the phenomenon. Now, I think that that has to do, there's an important teaching over here. And perhaps that's part of the purpose as well. Jews are often held back from doing the correct thing because they're always afraid of what the Gentiles will think of them. They're always afraid of what the Gentiles will say. So the need to find favor with the Gentiles and the idea that if we adhere to what the Torah requires, then the Gentiles won't like us, or they'll person, whatever, whatever. That's the feeling that many Jews have. Here you see just the opposite. Just the opposite. That to the extent that the Gentiles perceive the Jews as being the people of God, and that's what they perceived over here, to that extent, not only do they not, it does repress the feelings of hatred. Let's put it that way. There are feelings of animosity, but it puts those feelings in check, and it evokes the, it is possible to evoke a feeling of chen in the mind of the Gentiles. I think that it's not just telling us about something which happened then, but it's a lesson that there's a certain type of a behavior. It's not always going to be with the case of plagues and so on and so forth, obviously, but there is a certain type of a behavior when the Jews act in a certain manner. And then you have the element of divine providence, because when the Jews do reach a certain level of perfection, so then the divine providence will kick in. When that occurs, then that will evoke a new attitude from the nations toward the Jews. And that's the idea of chen. So this was extremely important at this point in time, that the Exodus also had to include that component. It would have been incomplete. Had the Jews left Egypt, and it was just an extraneous, an external thing, a physical thing, but that inner feeling of being degraded, a degraded people, with that self-image of a degraded people, that was their self-image. That too had to be addressed. And that's what the Ebenezer said, this pelagodol, that the phenomenon of degradation, that the Egyptians looked down upon them as slaves. Obviously that has to be the case. Nobody respects slaves. And there's degradation. Significant. It's not just an ordinary sense where you don't like someone. He's like nothing to you. He's a slave. That the slave, the masters, would have a complete transformation of attitude, and they would look up to these people as special individuals who they would want to lavish gifts upon. That's a great miracle. But that was essential to the phenomenon, that the goal was to transform the Jews from one type of people into a different type of people on every level, psychological as well as physical, and ultimately when they come to Sinai, they'd be ready to accept the Torah. So you see that I believe that's the story of that aspect of the transformation. It's interesting to note that the Jews are different throughout all of history. They've been more persecuted and afflicted than any other people. I don't think any people has such a long-term record of being persecuted and even destroyed, Holocaust, etc. No one has suffered as much. It's interesting, though, the Jews always are different. The Jews never seem to carry the grudges with them, even after the Holocaust. They're not. It's different than what I mentioned before. Those blacks in America that are angry, resentful, and always hateful. They just went on with their lives. Obviously, there are scars. I don't mean there is such a thing as a. It did. That's different.
There's no way.
The syndrome, the Holocaust survivor syndrome. But the amazing thing is the extent to which it didn't destroy, cripple them. Most of these people went on to build new lives for themselves. In terms of career, they made money, they got remarried, they had children. All right, obviously it had psychological effects. And they didn't become haters necessarily. Haters of all things German, they didn't. And the extent to which Jews took revenge against Nazis, it was very minimal after World War II. There were these squads that went around trying to locate them, which was legit. But you don't have that feeling that the Jews are people that are that are ruined by this anger and hatred and they can't go on. You don't have that. So that's an interesting aspect. They get over it. The Jew, even with the Arabs, it's an amazing thing. With everything the Arabs try to do to them, as soon as any Arab leader vaguely speaks about let's make peace, this and that, the Jews are jumping. They're ready to forgive, to forget, and let's move on. They don't bear these. They're not a people that bears grudges and hatreds and resentments.